So this is talking with Bill Shooter on 27th August 76 at Grenoble. So can you tell me when you joined the Jodl Group and what your background had been before then?
Yeah, perhaps I should tell, well, I had been educated at Rhodes University in Grahamstown, South Africa, and did a bachelor's degree of physics with honors, and then did a master's degree in radio astronomy, in which I built a little solar telescope, and this turned out to have been the first radio astronomy effort in South Africa.
I see.
We built a little helical antenna and detected solar bursts, type 3 bursts, and I wrote my master's thesis on solar bursts type 3.
Was this ever published?
This work was never published. Perhaps it should have been, but we were too naive about how to go about publishing papers.
So
I mean, at the time it would have been valid, and by the time we realized it was publishable, it was too late to publish it, so it sort of just disappeared. It's on file.
How did you get the inspiration to do this in such an isolated place?
Well, we had a senior lecturer in our department who was an X-radar person, and like X-radar people in other countries, he wanted to do some radio astronomy. His name was Stack Forsyth, and I believe he went to New Zealand. I haven't heard from him for years, but he supervised this work, and he provided the push and got the funds for this project.
And when was this project carried out?
This project was done in 1957-58. And then in the fall of 58, following completion of his master's degree, I applied to both Cambridge and Jodrell Bank. I was fortunately accepted at both places, but for financial reasons largely, I went to Jodrell Bank. I thought it would be easier to be independently financed, and that in fact turned out to be true, so that was, in my view, a fairly good decision. I would have had to have borrowed money to go to Cambridge, whereas I could be self-sufficient at
Jodrell Bank. I see
what you're saying. So that was what led to the choice of Jodrell.
And so when a new student arrives at Jodrell, how is it determined what you're going to work on?
Well, this was determined almost, I think, by letter before I arrived. It was told that there was a vacancy in the Zeeman effect, or 21-centimeter line group.
I see.
And a good project going on the attempt to measure the magnetic field of the galaxy by measuring the Zeeman effect on the 21-centimeter line. So that was more or less determined before I got there. I was told this is what I would be doing a thesis on.
And who was working on this before you got there?
Perhaps I should just tell you about the arrival at Jodrell Bank.
Yes, please do.
It was quite an exciting episode. In the early days at Jodrell, quite a lot of effort was put into tracking space probes. And I forget, at the time I arrived there, they were tracking a space probe. And so my impression on arriving at the place was coming to a gate and seeing policemen and all sorts of armed protection, I thought, gee, what a hell of a place.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they were clearly trying to keep, you know, unwanted visitors away, and I was wondering if I would have to show passports and passes, to get in. But it was really quite an amazing impression to come and see this heavily guarded place with newspaper reporters flocking around, and a general atmosphere of bustle, which is quite unusual, you know, quite different from anything I had ever seen before. When I got there, I met, in particular, John Galt, who is now in Canada, and Conrad Slater, who was a student there at the time. And John had set out, he was in a year's leave, I believe, at Jodrell while the Penticton telescope was being built.
Right.
And he decided to spend that year building equipment to study the Zeeman effect at 21 centimeters. Following a suggestion made in the literature by Bolton and Wild.
Right.
And we were the first people to ever try this thing. And at the time, it seemed as if it would be a very, well, technically quite difficult experiment, but you would spend your half hour and see this S-shaped curve, which is the differential of the 21-centimeter line. That would be it. You would have the magnetic field of the galaxy. And it turned out not to be quite that way.
What sort of strengths are you perhaps expecting?
Well, we thought the field would be something like something in the neighborhood of 10 to the minus 5 Gauss.
And based on what was the information?
Oh, there were predictions based on stability of spiral arms and so on. There was nothing very hard and fast, you know, this is why everyone wanted to measure it. But there were based on, I think, if I remember right, there were largely stability arguments that that gave numbers. Some of these early predictions were surprisingly good, but you only find that out afterwards.
Right. And So what were the special difficulties that you had, if any, in doing this experiment?
Well, when we actually started to do it, the telescope was in a very new state. Our receiver was a long way away from the telescope itself, and we spent a lot of time plowing through ditches, laying cables, and so on, to get from the front end of the receiver to the back end of the receiver. It was in a little hut far, the receiver was in a little hut far away from the control room, and we spent a lot of time plowing around in the muck, getting cables through to the receiver.
Why was it there?
Well, because the original setup of Jodrell was there were a lot of little huts where people had done the earlier projects before the big telescope.
Right.
And there just wasn't room in the control room area to have receivers. So that there was a laboratory under the telescope, the swinging lab.
Yeah.
And some of the receiver was in there, but the back end and the recorded charts were in this hut called the Noise Hut, because work on cosmic noise used to be done there.
The Noise Hut.
Yeah. The hut is still there, but it now looks a lot fancier and has additions, etc.
Right.
I don't know what it's used for anymore. Anyway, we had a lot of trouble getting the front end package on top of the telescope, because the early low frequency work usually had a feed up and then 30 or 40 feet of cable and then some kind of preamplifier. But to work at 21 centimeters, you clearly can't use 40 or 50 feet, 30 or 40 feet of cable. You have to have your preamplifier sitting right on top of your dipoles, whatever they were. I can't remember. It was a horn feed with cross probes. That's right. And we had a big job installing that. And I can recall standing around in the snow and at the top of this ladder at the focus, you know, sort of strapped on with one of these safety belts, John Galt there, trying to get the damn thing up and working. The main thing we had to fiddle up there is that we had two separate mixers, one on each orthogonal polarization.
Mm-hmm.
They were combined at IF with a quarter wave to produce circular with IF switches. And we had to get in there and adjust the crystal currents on each mixer to equalize. And
yeah.
So we had to go right up the ladder to to the top of the focus and screw around with a sort of socket wrench on the end of a long wand, you know, fiddle around trying to get these crystal currents. We had a lot of problems with the experiment, and I don't think we had got very far when one of the adjusting screws for one of the mixers came loose. And this was a fairly major catastrophe at the time. While all this was happening, John Galt had learnt that the telescope in Penticton was about to be delivered.
Mm-hmm.
And he went back to Penticton. So he left two very raw graduate students, Conrad Slater and myself, with this complicated piece of equipment on the telescope, and no real idea of how to handle the situation. And we were saved by Hanbury Brown, who stepped in and over the direction of this particular experiment. He really told us what we ought to be doing and how we ought to go about it, and observed with us and checked out the electronics. And he really took over directorship of this experiment in Galt's.
Even though he never was one of the co-authors, I don't believe.
Hanbury Brown wasn't a co-author, but he... I think he probably pushed the experiment from the beginning, you know, he certainly, I think he asked not to be a co-author. I think we asked him if he would be a co-author, and he said no, it was initiated by someone else, and I'm just keeping the things going. But he certainly saved that experiment. Anyway, as I was saying, one of the screws on one of these mixers had come loose, so we couldn't adjust and equalize the two mixers. And in order to adjust it, we had to turn the telescope upside down, let down a long pole which had this four-legged feed arrangement on the end of it, down to the base of the telescope, and then open things up and so on. And because of the design of the telescope, it was stabilized on a circular girder. It was not allowed to be turned upside down in winds exceeding 15 miles an hour. And we had to wait 3 weeks for the wind to drop. Then the wind dropped to below 15 miles an hour. We got this pole lowered down, opened it up, took a screwdriver, gave it half a turn, and hauled the whole thing back again, and we were in business. And then we did the experiment. Anyway, we had, by modern standards, a very primitive receiver. It was a single-channel receiver, and we had a channel for difference between left and right-hand circular polarization, and a channel showing the total power in narrow band, showing the absorption line. We were working on Cassiopeia.
Right.
The telescope tracking was really not very adequate to keep on Cass, and one had to readjust, maximize on Cass every 20 minutes so that one got a decent-sized signal.
And were you scanning in frequency very slowly
across
the line?
We were scanning slowly in frequency across the line, and the idea is you would see the absorption line and the polarization channel, if everything worked according to theory, should show you an S-shaped curve, which is the derivative of the absorption line. By comparing the size of this with the absorption line, you could get the field.
Right.
Well, things weren't quite that simple, because the two channels had slightly different filters in them. They weren't quite in the same frequency, and there were a few minor problems of this sort. But we did establish an upper limit, which I can't remember.
Well,
now.
Here it is. It's
5 × 10⁻⁵ Oersted, or Gauss. We had a long time arguing about whether this field should be Gauss or Oersted.
Right.
I guess nowadays you express magnetic fields in Gauss.
Yeah. Now, that was a bit higher than the 10⁻⁵ you said that people were predicting.
Yeah.
Is that not as low as you'd hoped to go?
No, we had an instrumental problem, is that we did not see an S-curve. But we did see on our polarization channel a curve which had the same shape as the absorption line. And we hadn't expected to see this.
Mm-hmm.
And that really limited what we could do in terms of getting a limit. So it was quite clear that the experiment could be improved.
I see.
It was probably due to cross-polarization or something like that. But it's so far back now, the details escape.
Well, then, in fact,
there was a systematic effect in there which did limit the accuracy. It wasn't a noise-limited experiment. So that it was quite clear that one had to go on and get a noise-limited experiment, which we eventually did.
This is a paper published in Nature in 1960?
That's correct. And there, our limit has changed.
Well, it didn't
from,
give the limit, unfortunately,
here.
See. But you looked at three sources, Cass, Taurus, and Sag.
Well, I think our best limit at that time was on the order of 5 × 10⁻⁶ Gauss.
I see, 10 times better.
Which is a factor 10 better. And this was mainly because we got rid of these spurious equipmental effects.
Right.
We had a completely redesign of the whole system. The previous system was scrapped and the new system was built.
I'm a little confused. Vasseur also did some experiments at Giotto. Was that a few years later?
Vasseur did the same in effect, started at Giotto in the fall of 1958, and it kept being done there. In fact, I think it stopped now, but it was done continuously there every year or so for about 10 years.
And his work was 63 or 4 or something like that?
No, it was a bit later than that, I think.
Even
it was
later
about
than that.
64 plus.
Yeah. Okay.
But for instance, Conrad Slater wrote his thesis on the first attempt to make, the first two attempts. He's an author of the second paper. My thesis had three attempts to measure the same effect in it. And by the time Vasseur came, I think he got to about attempt 7 or attempt 8 before he left and went to Greenbank and eventually successfully detected the magnetic field.
Right. Now, you mentioned also that after this, you stayed on at Giotto after you'd done your thesis, is this right, and worked out
only very
absorption?
Briefly. No, I had three attempts at the Zeeman effect, which were written up in my thesis, but I personally felt very unsatisfied by that. I wanted to do some astrophysics, and you can't do much astrophysics on negative results. So I had the idea of taking the absorption lines, which we had observed in great detail, because we kept scanning all the darn things. And I thought, well, I'll try and analyze, you know, why are these lines this shape and what are they doing and so on. And eventually a joint, this became the major part of interpretation in my own thesis. I didn't discuss the negative results in the negative field very much,
because
I can't say very much. But this became the major part of interpretation in my thesis, and a paper was published in 1964, it was submitted in 63, by myself and Herit Vasseur, which is an interpretation of, it's one of the first detailed attempts to interpret 21 centimeter absorption lines.
And what did you find?
Well, in a way it was quite successful because we found that we couldn't really match up the absorption lines and the emission lines nearby unless we assumed that there was hot gas in the emission, which we were not seeing in the absorption. And the conventional picture at the time was thinking of clouds, and we thought there might be some hot clouds which were present in the emission, which because of the selection effects and absorption.
So you weren't thinking of something that quite like Barry Clark's raisin pudding thing. You were thinking of hot clouds and cold clouds.
We were thinking of hot clouds and cold clouds. In the mission, you saw them both, right. And the hot clouds were quite prominent.
But definitely a step in that direction.
And the cold clouds were... You didn't see the hot clouds in absorption.
Yeah.
And Barry Clark was a PhD student at Caltech at about the same time, a little bit later, I believe. And he clearly extended our work by coming up with a two-component medium. I think we should have done it, but it's all, it's always easy to say.
Well, the interferometric data was also pointed that direction more clearly, I think, probably. Because the emission is resolved out entirely in the interferometer, and you can...
Yeah, the trouble they had was that we had emission taken with the same size telescope as the absorption, so that we... Whereas they didn't really have a system for measuring the emission properly.
That's true.
So they had some problems there too.
Yeah.
But certainly I think Barry Clark made a major contribution in terms of ideas by suggesting a two-component medium in pressure equilibrium,
which we hadn't still the canon today. When was your thesis actually? What was the date of it?
My thesis was submitted in January '63, and Barry's, I think, is 64 or 65. I know I took great delight the very first time I visited Owens Valley in going and reading his thesis and seeing what he had to say about things, because I had never seen this before. It was quite interesting.
I
shouldn't give ourselves too much credit, because there was a comment by Oort in, I think it's the Paris Symposium on Radio Astronomy. Muller from Leiden had shown some early... good 21 centimeter absorption spectra.
There was an article in Apshe by Mueller also.
That's right. And there was a comment by Oort, I think, on the spectrum of Cygnus, saying, why do you see emission there and not absorption? And that never got followed up very far. We found that out independently, but the germ of the idea was there before we came along. And, he pointed out there was a problem that should be looked at. It's a comment at the end of a paper by Muller, I think in the Paris Symposium on Radio Astronomy.
We
should give them credit for... incremental steps are made, and no one person really makes the big leap.
Sure.
And I'd like to credit people both before and afterwards.
Just in closing, I'd be interested in your comments about what it was like to work at Jodrell in the late 50s. What was the atmosphere? Were you sort of just in your own isolated group and you didn't really get very much of what the whole picture's going on? Or?
No. Jodrell in the late 50s was an ideal time to be there because the telescope had just been completed. And people from all directions and all countries were always dropping in there. So that one had a very open atmosphere. One was seeing people from all kinds of different observatories and talking to all kinds of different people. Our own group had Canadians, Australians, and all kinds of people like that. And it was a very interesting atmosphere to be in. At the present time, the equipment and telescope have all been considerably improved. The telescope job, I went observing at Jodrell a month ago, so I can compare, before and after. And the equipment now is just out of sight compared with what we used. Ours was extremely primitive. And it's all very flossy and all works very well now. You don't have to go through all the convolutions of making things work. We had to really find out how to use a large telescope.
Right.
Whereas nowadays people know how to use a large telescope.
Well, on the other hand, nowadays one doesn't understand so well because most students, including myself, have not worked with the nitty-gritty of electronics to the extent. I mean, they can know how to adjust a paramp, but they don't really... into the innards.
We had to build about, I don't know, I think I built three or four receivers or parts of them while I was at Manchester.
So,
and it is an advantage for people to know something about what you can do and what you can't do in electronics. You don't have to be able to get in with a soldering iron every time, but it's nice to know the limitations
exactly.
and how you can improve a situation, because a lot of, I know some cases from more recent experience where there was a very minor technical problem which could easily be cured, but the astronomer doesn't know that it's easy to cure because he doesn't know enough electronics to put his finger on how you do it. So there was a benefit in that. I think that we didn't get as much astrophysics as we would have liked.
Yeah.
We certainly didn't have the astrophysics that present students get. But you can't have everything.
No.
These things took a long time to be established and so on. But one certainly felt that one was doing ones that one had a lot of scientific independence. You were able to, you know, say that this should be done this way and make significant impacts in the equipment and ideas and so on at the time. So it was really quite an interesting time to have done a PhD thesis.
So. Right. Okay, well, thank
you
very
much. That's probably enough for your records.
Right. Yeah. That ends the interview with Bill Shooter on 27th August, 76.